The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio with Dr. Alex Hubline and Dr. Josh Claypo. This is Adapt or Perish.
This is Dr. Josh Claypo. Welcome to another episode of Adapt or Perish with Dr. Alex Hubline, president of Adaptogen. Oh my God, we have got a great topic today. I thought I was excited about the one we did about Rush. This one is even better because we are merging M&As with supergroups. I can't even talk. I'm so excited about it because it's things that we never think about. I mean, I think this was so great about this show. We think about business, we think about music, we sometimes think about music as a business, but now we are literally using supergroups today as an analogy, if some way, or a model for M&A. Are you as excited as I am?
I am super excited. Yeah, this is a lot of fun, right? Because we get to look at the parallels between completely different types of industries and different types of doing ways of doing things. And it's amazing the parallels that you see.
So, okay. So the first thing as we were going back and forth, we know about groups like, you know, the Traveling Wilburys with Tom Petty and Bob Dylan. We know about Damn Yankees. But I was telling you, when I was looking online, this was so great about the internet, Asia. And for some people, they're gonna have to check Asia. Yeah. You remember Asia. Asia was a super group that I did not know was a combination of, the band Yes, King Crimson and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Their number one hit, their big hit was Heat of the Moment and Only Time Will Tell. I don't know how many more songs they had beyond that, but let me ask you this. Because this is just what popped to the top of my head. There are so many mergers and acquisitions that go on. We're going to talk about the successes and stuff, but I wonder how much the public knows in some cases about a company that really was the formation of multiple small companies. You know, obviously there's the headline ones, but like for this one, Asia's a good example. I had no idea that there were three prominent bands that made, you know, how aware are we of mergers and acquisitions that don't make the giant headlines?
Yeah, I mean, unless you're involved in one, you generally don't hear a lot about them, but they happen every day, right? And they happen across all kinds of different industries. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different motivations for, you know, corporate M&A. You know, a lot of people are looking to expand their market share, or they're looking to, you know, maybe reduce some competition or grow their business or acquire talent or whatever it is. So there's a lot of different objectives behind these things, but I think a lot of people don't realize how often these things happen. And I think what's interesting about it is when you look at mergers and acquisitions, and I think this really parallels the whole supergroup concept, is that the large majority of them, I would even say the vast majority of them, don't really end up living up to the expectations and the business results that people had set for those acquisitions. And, you know, when I was looking through the list of supergroups, and by the way, I was actually listening, ironically enough, to Heat of the Moment from Asia on my way to the office this morning. It's on one of my playlists, and so I thought that was pretty funny.
Guilty pleasures, right? Guilty pleasure?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I think that there's some interesting parallels there, though, because when you look at a lot of the supergroups, and there's some notable exceptions like Asia or Led Zeppelin or whomever, but, you know, most of them didn't turn out to be the, you know, super groups that people thought they were going to be in terms of longevity, in terms of album sales, in terms of popularity past a certain point. So I think there's a lot of parallels there between what happens in the corporate world when we're acquiring companies and when musicians are getting together trying to form super groups. There seems to be this sort of disconnect between, you know, what the expectations are and then what the reality is in a lot of cases.
Well, okay. So, but how does that, I mean, given that, those numbers and given the percentage, why do we do mergers and acquisitions? I mean, you talked about gain market share, get rid of the competition, but I guess one of the things I was thinking, and I don't know so much about the timeline on this, and here's where the parallel is in music, I think, although I don't want to believe this, you know, if I'm putting together a band like the Damn Yankees, is it, hey, let's get together, you know, we can create some great music. And because of our status, we can make a lot of money in the short run, right? And that's, we've all been successful. It doesn't matter the longevity. And I was kind of thinking about that in terms of mergers and acquisitions. You know, is it that we're putting companies together or acquiring companies for greater longevity of success? Or is it sometimes a market grab and a money grab? And that sounds bad, but, you know, those are very different different goals. What are your thoughts about that one?
No, I think you're right. And I think sometimes it is just about the bottom line in a corporate acquisition. And I think it's also the same way with some of the supergroups. I mean, some of these supergroups like Cream, for instance, back in the 60s, yeah. You know, you had three great musicians there, right? You had Clapton, you had Jack Bruce, one of the greatest bass players of all time. You had Ginger Baker, one of the absolute famous drummers, got together. They probably sold a bunch of albums, but it was for a very short period of time. And so, you know, I don't know. I think that maybe in the music world, I think maybe you get these super groups and you get these collaborations more from I want to go explore new directions and I want to do things from a creativity standpoint that maybe I can't do myself or I can't do within the confines of my current band. And so I think there's an aspect of that. And I think it parallels what happens in the corporate world as well. You know, a lot of companies, particularly high tech companies, they'll make acquisitions as one of their primary sources of innovation. You know, they look at some of these smaller companies and they say, wow, there's some really smart people here. They've done some really innovative things. And you know what? I probably can't compete or get to where they've gotten to as quickly. So I'm just going to go buy them and I'm going to include them in my innovation portfolio. So I think there's some parallels between that, you know, need of musicians to go off and be more creative, because almost by definition, they're creative people. They want to go out and innovate. They want to expand their horizons from a creativity standpoint. And I think you see a parallel with that in the corporate world from an innovation standpoint and from a being able to adapt to changing market conditions. And
okay, so here's the next where my head is going. And again, it's so interesting. We're going pinging back and forth. I've been involved in mergers and acquisitions, both as a company that got acquired. I've consulted on mergers and acquisitions. And, you know, so much of it, besides the dollars and the finances and stuff, is literally it's somewhere between a super group and like the Brady Bunch, right? We're going to bring these people together. We're bringing these companies together. It looks really good on paper, you know, because of all the different skills. But now everybody is in either the same room, or we've got to get under the same label, or we've all got to get the same HR system. Or in your case, you know, now we have disparate technologies that maybe need to come together because we didn't just buy you and put you off to the side. We made you part of the family. How does Adaptogen help there? Because I've seen it's messy. I mean, I know you've been involved in that as well. It gets really messy. When it comes down to just literally people working together and trying to figure out how to make it cohesive.
Well, yeah, and you're right. I mean, acquisitions can be really disruptive to companies if you don't do them carefully and you're not good at it, right? It kind of throws everything up into the air. And when you think about sort of a corporate acquisition, you know, I like to think of it as there's sort of three phases to it. There's the strategy phase where you're trying to work out, well, who should I acquire and why should I acquire them? And then there's a due diligence phase where you go through and you actually look under the covers and say, does this really make sense from a financial standpoint? Does it make sense from a business standpoint? You kind of go in and you actually, you know, get the data that you need to make a good decision. And then once you've done the acquisition, there's kind of a third big phase, and that's integration. And I think, you know, and it's not just integration of the companies, it's people, it's processes, it's technologies and systems. You've got to make all of this stuff work together. And I think that's one of the areas that we see a lot of companies fall down in, is in that integration phase, that post-merger integration phase or post-acquisition integration phase. And I think one of the big elements that it comes down to, I see two personally. One of them is culture. And I think that's maybe why some of the super groups in music maybe didn't go as far as they wanted to go, was because, you know, almost by definition, when you create a super group, you're taking some really, really talented and really creative people that are, that have already been successful, and you're putting them together. And so you're bound to have conflicts. You're bound to have some creative differences and some, you know, some issues maybe with where you want to go with the band and where you want, what direction you want to go. I think you run into the same problem in the corporate world, right? If you try to acquire companies that have a vastly different culture and you care about acquiring talent and the people, a lot of times you also see that conflict. So I think there's a lot of parallels there. And then you've got to integrate the people, the processes, the culture, the technology, the, you know, all of that has to get integrated. And I think that's where a lot of these things fall down. And that's one of the areas we try to help people with, is how can we help you integrate the systems better? And that takes a lot of the pressure off of the other aspects, which I think are in many regards more complex, right? Trying to merge cultures together.
Yeah.
Wow, that's complicated. And it's not an exact science. As much as we'd like to think it's an exact science, it really isn't. It's something where, you know, you're using some principles you've learned over time, hopefully, if you're good at it. But if you have radically different cultures, you can run into huge problems, even if you do the rest of the post-acquisition integration really, really well.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, because when we talk about merging cultures, I was just thinking about sort of the damn Yankees as an example. They were all, if you will, successful companies. You got Ted Nugent, you got Tommy Shaw, you got Jack Blaze, right? They had revenue already there. They're sitting on money. They're coming together, and then there's this down period, right, where they're either writing songs together. They're trying to sort of get their stuff together, much like a merger acquisition. There's the down period where the new company is not, if you will, ready yet. And you're either relying on reserves or potentially the revenue from the individual, contributors. How do companies deal with that? How much downtime, when I say downtime, if you will, how long before the new company reasonably should be making money? Because you could have unrealistic expectations. Hey, y'all, we're going to put you all together. We want you to be a new company, and we're going to go out and start selling. But that doesn't happen because of all the things that you said. What's in your experience? How long before you should be able to hit the ground running and be able to generate revenue in a merged or an acquired situation?
Well, you know, I think it really depends on the nature of the, you know, acquirer and the acquirees, right? A lot of times it comes down to the strategy that you use from an integration approach standpoint. So for instance, you know, some companies will go off and they will make an acquisition and they will just kind of leave that acquisition on their own for a while. And they'll slowly over time try to integrate it into the rest of the company. And in some circumstances, that works really, really well. You know, you kind of just let them run. You integrate the points that you need to integrate. So maybe, for instance, you integrate the sales forces so they can sell one another's products, right? And maybe you do some integration from an accounting or finance standpoint, but you kind of leave the rest of it to sort of run on its own for a while. And I think a really good example of that strategy is the recent acquisition of Red Hat software by IBM. You know, IBM bought these guys, I think it was a $38 or $39 billion acquisition. And for the most part, they've kind of left them alone. They've said, you know, you guys kind of keep doing what you're doing. You're making a lot of money. This is great. It adds to our bottom line. And we're not terribly interested in trying to, you know, get you into the broader company as quickly as possible. So that's one strategy, right? And there's pros and cons to each of these. The second strategy is no. We're going to do the opposite of that. We're going to fully absorb you into the mothership or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna do it as quickly as we can, right? We want to integrate the people, the processes, the culture, the systems, the technologies, all of that. We want to integrate very, very quickly. And so that can have its own time frame around it, right? In terms of the business results you're looking for, as well as getting the companies merged together. There's other companies though that go out there and say, you know what? Instead of trying to say one is going to acquire the other or one is going to subsume the other, they'll look at it from a best of breed standpoint. So they'll look at it from an adopt and go standpoint. They'll say, who's got the better accounting department? Mm-hmm. And they'll pick one, right? Or who's got the better whatever department and systems and processes? And we'll pick those and then we'll merge them together on that basis, right? So it's almost like a best of breed approach for pulling together companies. And then you also have companies that say, you know what, we're going to focus on where are the points that we need to integrate these companies quickly that will derive the most business value. So we're going to focus on three or four areas where we know we're going to get huge synergies from integrating things in very tightly together. And then we're going to take our time to integrate the rest of it. So you get these four different approaches. And so I think the timelines and the, you know, route to profitability and so on and so forth, that tends to be something that it varies widely. And there's no one right strategy. But I think that when you look at it from an overall standpoint, part of that acquisition process is making sure that you choose the right strategy that makes sense for both businesses, that makes sense for the market, that makes sense for what you're trying to accomplish from an objective standpoint.
You know, I was just thinking as you were talking, we're almost splitting, if we're going to use the music analogy. On the one hand, we're sort of talking about super groups, and that's that's kind of more of a merger. But it got me thinking about like Motown, right? Or the record label, where we're going, because you talked about acquisitions and sort of leaving them alone. We're going to go find groups that we're going to bring, and it's going to be a part of our portfolio. And to your point, we're not going to merge them together. We got a label that has, or a company, and we see this today, that's got 17 different groups, and we may have a company that's got 17 different products. And yes, they, you know, like you said, accounting, certain processes are integrated across, but the groups themselves, the divisions themselves, the companies themselves are not necessarily functioning together. I mean, they're their own revenue streams versus like the Motown, we're going to bring in artists, or now that I'm getting, this is really ridiculous, the Monkees, boy bands, you know, where you started bringing people together, which maybe is a little bit different, but it all, so here's the question I want to ask you about, because it, and maybe this is because I'm a psychologist, it always comes down to, because you even talked about, even we're going to use the company that's got the best, you know, financial processing software or practices. Now you get into culture issues, right? Well, you know, what do you mean they're going to use yours and not ours? What do you mean you guys do sales this way and we do sales this way? How do you, can you smooth that over? And have you seen that? How have you seen that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can. And again, I think it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. So, you know, I worked back in the day, this is probably 20 years ago. I worked for HP when HP merged with Compaq, right? Two very, very large companies merging together to try to get synergies out of what they were doing. And one of the things that we did during that post-integration or post-acquisition integration process was we did one of these adopt and go approaches. And, you know, and I will tell you, it led to a lot of challenges that for sure, but I think overall it was a really neat strategy because you kept sort of teams intact that had been working together for a long period of time. And you weren't trying to, you know, merge these teams together and end up with a lot of the conflict that you would have had in sort of a fully absorptive type of acquisition. So I think it, you know, and HP and Compaq back then had very, very different cultures. They were two of the most different cultures I've ever seen. So I think merging those cultures together across the board would have been really very, very difficult. So instead, the company said, you know what, we're going to do some of that, of course, but we're going to try to go forward with this adopt and go strategy because it minimizes that cultural conflict. And it also lets us move very, very quickly. And so for that particular acquisition, you know, I think in many regards, that strategy worked probably better than trying to go and fully integrate every department, every sort of function that was out there. It kind of kept a lot of the continuity from both companies. And it created a fairly unique culture because you had this mix of organizations and mix of cultures, but within the teams themselves or the departments or the divisions or whatever, you didn't have a lot of that cultural conflict.
Do you, you know, particularly in a fast-paced environment, you've got companies that are merging, whether they're merging on their own, they're being brought together by a venture capital organization. And I was thinking about, you talk about, you know, depends on what your goals are for success, et cetera. Is it sometimes that we're going to bring you together to get a bolus of revenue and we're not thinking long-term? you know, almost like, I don't want to say flipping a house, but kind of. We're going to bring these things together. We're going to make this thing look awesome. We're going to increase its value, and then we're going to turn it over because we don't, you know, rather than trying to see how well it works. And how do you create a culture of work? Because, you know, these are people working, right? There's actually people have to do this. How do you make that work? Versus we're bringing this together for the long run.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. And I think one of the things that's changed maybe over the last 20 or 30 years is I think people's time horizons have gotten a lot shorter. So I think if you did an acquisition maybe 30 years ago or even longer ago, I think people just in general had a longer term perspective on things. But, you know, we talked about in one of our recent episodes of this show, you know, this idea that the average lifespan of a company in the S&P 500 in the last 50 or 60 years has gone from like 60 years down to about 15 years or something like that. So I think there's this expectation that, you know, companies are shorter lived now than they ever have been. And that's just something that I think people have accepted. So you do see strategic acquisitions where you are looking at the long term. You're looking at it purely from a, how can we make money now? But maybe more importantly, this is going to lay the foundation for us to make a lot of money down the road. And there's certainly a number of those. But then there's also what I'll call sort of these transitional or transactional acquisitions where people say, you know what, I can acquire this company and I can make a boatload of money over the next 5 to 7 years. And after that, I really don't care because I made a boatload of money. So I think you see both. But I think the overall expectation is that these companies don't live as long as they used to. Mm-hmm. And so you almost have in every scenario have a situation where you're thinking on a much more short term basis than maybe we were 20 or 30 years ago.
So what role does, and I don't know if it does, but what role, I'm thinking of the people, and you know, you're brought together and there's a short lifespan. Maybe you've been involved in companies before where there was a merger or an acquisition, and you as an individual, you're working for this company. I don't know how much longer I have or we have. And I'm going to work hard. I'm going to get through this tumultuous time. And then we may be sold. What role does a company like Adaptogen? I mean, I know it's to streamline things, but I was trying to make the connection between what a software company can do, not only to make the company more successful or the merger or the acquisition more seamless, but how does that translate down to, you know, me, Josh, who is involved personally in this merger acquisition, not from the M&A side, but I work for one of these companies. How does it end up trickling down to me?
Yeah, no, I think it trickles down. I mean, I think a lot of these acquisition and merger scenarios, you know, they not only affect the company, but they affect individuals. And so, you know, what you see a lot of times when you do particularly fairly large scale acquisitions is that one of the things that they're predicated on is this idea of cost synergies. And that's really just a polite way of saying,
right,
hey, you know what? We don't need two accounting departments.
That's right, right, right.
Right. We don't need two HR departments. We, you know, all there's duplicate functions. And part of how we're going to finance this thing and cost justify it is that we're going to eliminate some people as a result. So I think there can be a very direct impact. And I've been through acquisitions where, you know, there were just round after round of layoffs, and it's very disruptive because, you know, nobody knows when their time is up, right? So that can be very disruptive in an acquisition. You have to be very careful in terms of how you do it. And then you kind of look at it also from the systems side. You know, there's all these systems that run your company. There's processes, there's systems, there's technologies. And so, you know, one of the things we do at Adaptogen is really try to streamline the systems integration process, right? I've got all of these duplicate systems that are out there. And now I have to figure out how to make all of those systems work together. And I have to figure out how to migrate the data and a lot of the transaction systems. I've got to get those into one system, hopefully, right, in order to achieve some of those cost synergies. So the cost synergies aren't just on the people side. They're on the systems and processes side. How much of this duplicate stuff can I eliminate and how quickly can I do it? So that's what we spend a lot of time helping our customers do, is streamline that process, speed that process up, So you can focus on more, some of the more complex elements, like we talked about, like the cultural integration. Wow, that is a really, really complex thing to go out and do, particularly if you have two companies that are very, very different in terms of their corporate culture and their philosophy of doing things.
You made a statement, which I'm gonna push back on you, but I think you and I are on the same wavelength on this, but maybe not. I'm about to find out.
Do it.
No, so you hear this all the time. So I'm a psychologist, right? I'm a psychologist who works in business. So I'm more of the org behavior, but I'm really more, you know, clinical. You come from the business side and the strategy side. And there's always this debate about, is a company, if you will, or an organization, a living, breathing thing, entity, or is it the sum of its people? In other words, can an organization, if you will, because we describe organizations as thriving, as not thriving, as dying, as wounded, et cetera. And people, I've seen papers where people argue the company, the organization is its own thing. Now, I've seen people who argue on the other side. I tend to be on the other side. It is the sum of its people. Even if it's something greater, it does not live on its own. Where do you stand on that? Which probably has nothing to do with this, but I've always been curious about where do you stand on that?
No, I stand, and part of this, I think it depends on the industry, right? If I were maybe in the, you know, oil and gas industry or the mining industry, where I have a company that has a ton of assets, hard assets like mines and land and whatever it may be, you know, you could maybe make the argument that the company is its own thing. The people are there to basically maximize the value of those assets over time, right? But when you get into other industries, like particularly the software industry, I'm very much on your side there. A software company really truly is just a sum of the collection of its people. And I joke with people, they say, what do you do for a living? What is Adaptogen? At the end of the day, what do you guys do for a living? And I say, well, you know, we produce really, really long strings of ones and zeros. That's all software is, right?
Right.
Y'all
are much more than that. Come on.
No, we are. But at the end of the day, if you look at our finished product, it is a big, giant, long string of ones and zeros at the end of the day, right?
Right.
But all of those ones and zeros, all of the stuff that we produce comes from the heads of our people, right? It comes from the minds of the people that are building it and working on it. And so I think it depends a little bit on the industry, but I'm with you. I think that when you really look at companies today, and I think this is going to become more and more true over time, it really is all about the people. And you've got very unique skill sets in a lot of these companies. You know, you've got brilliant engineers, you've got brilliant innovators. And they're the ones that are ultimately driving the finished product, as opposed to maybe what I'll call more hard asset industries, where you're producing physical products and you've got, you know, manufacturing plants and distribution systems and all that. And maybe you could argue a little more that it's not so much on the people. So I don't think it's kind of a binary decision there or a binary argument. I think it's to varying degrees, people are much more important in some industries than maybe they are in others.
So should a company, because I've seen it, you're doing the due diligence, you're looking at the different assets, you're trying to figure out how to bring people together. And again, I think a company like Adaptogen is interesting because do we need to think about Adaptogen during the due diligence, before the merger and acquisition, or are we thinking about Adaptogen and what it brings to the market afterwards? Because it's an interesting thing. Am I thinking about it as, okay, I'm going to need XYZ in order to do this? Or is it now we've merged or we've acquired, we got this problem, we need Adaptogen and the software that they bring, software solutions that they bring?
Well, you know, we'd like for it to be the former, right? We'd like for people to be considering this kind of in the due diligence phase. And one of the things you do in the due diligence phase is you say, all right, what kind of cost synergies can I achieve here? Because a lot of times that goes to straight to the bottom line, and it goes to the business plan and the justification for making the acquisition, right? But most people don't get down to that level of detail. They kind of estimate, well, what is it going to cost us to integrate the people? What is it going to cost us to integrate the processes? What is it going to cost us to integrate the systems? But they do it, I think, at maybe a little bit higher level than when we get involved. So we'd love for it to be in that sort of due diligence phase where people are saying, wow, how can we reduce these integration costs and go looking for solutions and due diligence? But it tends to be sort of after the fact, right? After they've done the acquisition. But what we're trying to do with some of our customers now is some companies are just serial acquirers. They just acquire company after company after company. And it's part of their business strategy. It's an integral part of their long-term strategy. And so you say to yourself, how can we help these companies build a capability to go off and do this repeatably over time? So it's not just this one acquisition they're going to do. They're going to do 20 over the next 4 or 5 years. How do we help them build an integration capability that they can reuse over and over and over again to streamline the process and make it a lot more predictable? That's what we started working with our customers on over the last couple of years. And you know, the early results on it are very, very good.
Okay. I don't know where you're ever going to hear a mashup between M&A and supergroups other than on Adaptive Paris. Alex, we are out of time. What an amazing, amazing segment. I can't wait to the next show. If you like what you're hearing, you need to stay tuned to Tony Curry Radio because we're coming up with another episode coming soon of Adapt or Perish.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.